MacCast, Sunday, December 9th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's been an interesting week this past week in Apple and Mac news. It seems like this time of year, everything sort of begins to wind down, to slow down a little bit. So there's not a whole lot going on. We've got some good stories to get into. I don't know if you caught probably the biggest story of the week. We're not going to dive into too much. We'll brush on it a little bit. But I think it's been analyzed a lot in a lot of different places. And that was the interview that Tim Cook did for Bloomberg, as well as the subsequent television interview that aired on NBC's Rock Center. If you didn't catch either of those things, you probably should go check them out. The Bloomberg pieces are a particularly good read. Lots of little tidbits in there, but a lot of the same stuff we've heard Apple sort of saying before. The big news, of course, coming out of all of this having to do with Apple starting to do some manufacturing in the U.S. I think that was a bit of a shock. And then some statements about basically Apple TV moving from being just a hobby in Tim Cook's mind to an area of intense interest. Although I don't know if that's much of a change. I think he's sort of, if you listen to the quarterly conference calls, you've heard him talk about the stuff they're doing in television and sort of the experimenting with the Apple TV and stuff like that. And I think it's been something that Apple's been pursuing and looking into for a long time, but likely something that they're running into some issues just with the bureaucracy or the politics, I think, of the television industry and licensing and content and things like that. So I think those areas frustrate Apple. I think they think they can make an impact, but they're still not ready, I don't think, to move forward. A lot of people still predicting that Apple's going to do some sort of television product in 2013. If that does happen, my personal opinion is it'll be toward the end of the year, but we'll just have to wait and see. So those were interesting things to check out, but we have a bunch of news and stuff to get into, as well as some questions and hints and tips and tricks. I got some great iTunes 11 tips lined up for you. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, if you're hoping to pick up a new iPhone, maybe an iPad this holiday season, before you get that new one, make sure that you sell your used phone or gadget to Gazelle. That way you can get some cash that you can use for making that new purchase, for getting that upgrade. Gazelle is really great, I think, because it's so simple and straightforward. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com. Tell them a little bit about the condition of your device. They'll even take broken iPhones and iPads for cash, so don't be afraid to just plug it in there and see what kind of offer you might get. And that's exactly it. You get an upfront, risk-free offer, and that price that you see is locked in for 30 days. So you could even pick up your new device before you have to send in the old one to Gazelle. And Gazelle will send you a box if you'd like. You can send your item in, and they will even pay for the shipping. Once they receive it, they're going to process it quickly, and you can get paid by check or by PayPal. It really is that simple, and you don't have to deal with any of the hassles of auction websites or doing online classifieds, and just the risks and concerns that you have with that are taken out by using Gazelle. So what's your iPhone or iPad worth? Just take a minute now. Go to gazelle.com, and you can find out, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Apple extended the global reach of its iTunes store empire this week. They launched finally in Russia, Turkey, and Lebanon. Music pricing over there seems to be a little bit more affordable than it is here in the States, although I'm not really sure once you adjust for economic differences and exchange rates and things like that. But according to the stuff I was reading, tracks are expected to be about 15 rubles in Russia, which translates to about 49 cents US. Over here, most tracks are $1.29, so that seems to be a significant discount. Over in Turkey, they're saying the prices are 0.89 Turkish lira per track, which translates to about 50 cents US. And albums in Turkey are priced at 9.99 lira, which is about $5.59 US. So I wish I could buy stuff over on the Russian and the iTunes store. I'm not sure how the selection varies. And again, there could be other factors playing into how the pricing sorts out. I know that Apple does its licensing deals and things with the music industry. They have to negotiate that in each country that they do business in. So there may be some differences there in terms of the royalty payments and how much they have to pay to get access to that content in those regions. iTunes customers in Russia are also getting access to Apple's iCloud iTunes Match subscription service that reportedly costs about 799 rubles per year, which apparently is very close to the $25 a year US pricing. Unfortunately for Apple, though, the Russian launch was hit with a somewhat embarrassing slip-up. There were reports that some of the links on the iTunes store resulted in some users seeing and getting access to porn within the iTunes store interface. No one's 100% sure exactly what happened, and of course Apple isn't saying, but what it seems to look like is that the web developers potentially put in some placeholder URLs and set the URL string to xxx.xxx. And while that may be okay for use as a variable in a mathematical formula, it has potentially embarrassing effects when used for a URL string. That's because the XXX domain was recently set aside and reserved for use by porn websites. And in this case, it looks like the XXX.XXX domain was reserved by a porn website search engine. So clicking on the links would take users to that site within the context of the iTunes store browser, making it look like the content was being delivered by the iTunes store. That's because essentially the iTunes store is just basically a website and it functions with WebKit inside the iTunes app. And so it just went ahead and happily loaded and displayed whatever content it was pointed at. Apple did respond quickly and resolved the issue, but not after word of the issue got out. So a little bit embarrassing. And it was surprising to me that there wasn't actually security measures or things in place to prevent the iTunes store from actually going out and accessing websites outside Apple's own servers. You think they would have them locked down and restricted to that. There may be legitimate reasons, though. There could be third-party applications or third-party web services and things like that that they have integrated that they need to be able to reach out and access. I could imagine now, after this incident, though, they might go back and look at locking down at least specific domains or top-level domains like .xxx, but we'll have to see. I have a feeling we won't be seeing this happen in future iTunes Store launches. This week, the future of Apple's Pro Audio products were called into question, at least by one source, prompting a response from Apple. Ars Technica reported that Apple has responded to claims that it has been severely downsizing its Pro Audio teams and that the next big audio application from Apple would be for the iPad, therefore implying that Apple would be continuing to ignore the Pro Audio market for the Mac. The rumors started when the site Pro Tools Expert ran a report that claimed the teams were decimated and that their sources claimed that the Pro Audio team was virtually gone from Apple. The report further claimed that the team in Europe was down to just two employees. Apple denied the claim when they were contacted by a concerned customer via email for Tim Cook. The email was responded to by the music and marketing head, Xander Soren, and Soren said that the team was in fact intact and hard at work on the next version of Logic Pro. So how did all this hubbub get started? I think this is just another one of those cases, as so often happens in these stories, especially in the current culture of sort of traffic-grabbing headlines. The whole thing just seems to be a big misunderstanding or misinterpretation of the story. Russ Hughes of Pro Tools Expert contacted Mac Rumors, and he wanted to make clear that his original report said nothing about Apple's development work on Logic and that it only addressed the specialist team that assists professional users with using the software tools. So more of a support team being cut back than the actual developers of the Logic software. And that led to a bunch of other blogs sort of republishing the headlines and just getting the gist of the story wrong. But, you know, that said, I think pro users have had reason to be a little bit edgy, and that also helps fuel these kinds of reports. Many pro users were not happy with the changes that happened to Final Cut 10. You remember that whole fiasco? And then there's been the issue of the Mac Pro getting kind of long in the tooth Tim Cook did address that this year, assuring pro customers that Apple was going to have something coming for them in 2013, but it still has seemed like Apple hasn't been paying a lot of attention to the pro market and really focusing on the consumer market, especially the iPad and tablets. And then you add to that that Logic Pro itself hasn't seen a major revision since 2009, and you can fully understand how things might get a little bit crazy and how pro customers might be a bit concerned about what Apple is up to. It doesn't help either that Apple is always secretive about their future products and launches and things like that. So really, customers have no idea what Apple's up to. And the longer and longer time they take to get out new products or put out updates, the more and more concerns grow. So there you have it. Apple seems to be continuing to beef up its efforts in the area of custom chips and processors. According to a piece on the Next Web, over the past few weeks, Apple's been hiring dozens of engineers for its research center in Israel. In December, Apple acquired an Israeli memory technology firm, Anobit, and since then, there have been reports that Apple has had plans to open a research center in the region. Texas Instruments recently started letting go as many as 250 employees from their Israeli development center, and Apple is supposedly turning that into an opportunity to pick up some new talent. Since January, Apple's been looking to hire hardware engineers for chip development with strong emphasis in electrical circuits, analog and hardware testing and verification. A number of the engineers from Texas Instruments were focused on development of OMAP and ARM-based system-on-a-chip designs, and also radio chipsets, including Wi-Fi and Bluetooth technologies. Apple isn't commenting on the hirings, but under Apple's recent management restructuring, you remember Bob Mansfield was put in charge of a brand new technologies group, which does include all of Apple's semiconductor and wireless technology teams. So these new employees would be a good fit to fall under his leadership. The hirings also seem like a good move and also seem to show that Apple really is serious about moving forward with their own chip designs. The A6 processor was Apple's first fully custom chip design, and it's believed that Apple may be looking to develop more fully custom chips for their notebook and desktop products, as well as for use in tablets and the iPhone. Apple has been making big advances in semiconductor designs, and acquisitions and hirings like these have enabled them to quickly become a leader in the field. Being able to fully develop and customize chips allows Apple to integrate the hardware and software in their designs and better maximize performance and battery efficiency, giving them a lead over their competitors. So I think it's not surprising to see Apple taking advantage of this opportunity to pick up some new engineering talent. Another thing that's been happening recently in Apple's semiconductor area is there have been rumors that Apple is looking to move the actual chip fabrication away from Samsung. Apple does not do their own production of chips, but rather does the designs and then hands them off to another company for fabrication. Currently, for the A6 processors, that partner is Samsung. So far, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, TSMC, has been rumored as the logical choice of Apple moving that chip production to. But this week, analyst Doug Freeman of RBC Capital recently said that Apple may also be talking to Intel for that production. And while that does seem possible and very interesting, Apple has partnered with Intel in the past. Obviously, Intel provides the chips for Apple's desktop and notebook systems. The Mac Observer's Brian Chafin wrote an interesting piece and points out several reasons why Intel might be an unlikely choice to be Apple's future chip production partner. One being that Apple designs ARM-based chips, and that's something that Intel really doesn't care for since it's not their technology. Intel doesn't make ARM chips, and it isn't something that they're probably very likely interested in doing. Of course, Apple could move away from ARM-based processors and use more Intel technologies, but based on the companies Apple's acquired and the kinds of engineers they've been hiring who are very focused on ARM-based architectures, that doesn't seem very likely. Another thing that Brian points out is that Intel currently doesn't make chips for any other fabless chip design company. They're in the business of making their own chip designs, and they don't produce chips for any other company. Apple could be a big enough partner for them to consider doing it, but really it seems like Intel prefers to control chip design and manufacturing beginning to end, and they'd probably prefer Apple just to buy their chips and leave the design up to them. So I have to see. Maybe there's enough money in it for Intel, and certainly I believe that Apple is talking to Intel about it, but I still believe that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, who also has been a partner of Apple's for years, would be the logical choice. If you're looking to upgrade that shiny new iMac that you just picked up, you may be in for a surprise, at least depending upon which model that you ended up purchasing. Now that the new units are hitting the streets, we are getting details of how easy or difficult it may be, if not impossible, to perform aftermarket upgrades on Apple's newly designed machine. The iFixit teardown revealed that on the 21.5-inch model, it will require ungluing the display if you want to change out the hard drive or add RAM. Pretty much you have to disassemble the whole thing and take the logic board out even to get to the RAM slots. So it's a pretty extreme upgrade. On the base model, there's also no SSD option, and iFixit confirmed that the logic board doesn't even have the proprietary connector on the logic board from the factory. There are traces there that seem to indicate where it would go if it were installed, but the connector isn't installed at all, at least on the base model. So you only get the SATA connector where the iMac's 2.5-inch hard disk is. So you could swap out the hard disk, you could add an SSD using that one SATA connector, but as far as installing an additional hard drive, at least in the base model 21.5-inch unit, that's not looking like it's going to be possible. If you opt for the 27-inch model, though, swapping out RAM is actually a piece of cake, at least once you find the magic little button to access the panel you need to access. Cult of Mac points out that there is a memory access port located on the back of the iMac. It's just under the stand and just under the cooling vents. There's a little panel there. The release button for the panel, though, is a little bit hidden. It's actually under the power cord connector, so you need to disconnect the power cord, something you want to do when you install RAM anyway, so that's actually probably a good design decision. But you pop that off, and then you'll see a little release button. Press that in, and that will give you access to the RAM slots. The little door pops out, or little panel comes off, more accurately, and then you can have full access to the RAM slots. What's interesting is that that option isn't available on the 21.5-inch model. It may be because the location of the logic board and where the memory slots are on that unit are off-center, so they wouldn't be right there in line under the stand. They'd be off, I think, to the right side, if I'm doing my sort of mirror flipping from the images that I saw correctly. And it may just be that, for aesthetic reasons, Apple didn't want to have a door sitting there off to the side. That's just my personal speculation, but it seems likely when Apple's making design decisions, they don't like to have, you know, those lines, those smooth lines and curves jarred by anything like that. On the 27-inch model, it's pretty well hidden. I didn't even notice from the original images that there was a door there. You actually have to be specifically looking for it. If that was off to the side, just right on the back unit, back of the unit on either side, left or right, it would be pretty noticeable. So bottom line is, in either unit, upgrading the hard drive is going to be pretty difficult. And if you want to be able to perform your own memory upgrade, you're likely going to want to go with a 27-inch model. For folks who did order that 27-inch model, though, depending upon when you ordered it from Apple, you may or may not be getting that Mac before the end of the year. Apple has moved up ship times for the new pre-orders into next year. So if you were to order one today, you're not going to be getting it until January. Even if you ordered it when they went on pre-sale on November 30th, Apple seems to be giving ship dates between December 21st and 28th. That's according to Ars Technica. So that means that it still might not land on your door until after the new year. Apple this week released its third beta of iOS 6. iOS 6.1 Beta 3 was released to developers. In it, there are several changes, including changes to the iCloud setup, which now asks you to confirm your Apple ID and password for FaceTime and iMessage. It also asks you how you want people to contact you on those services and lets you know that you can change that setting later. There were some changes to the default Passbook card that is in the Passbook application specifically for UK users. Apple changed the terms movie tickets to cinema tickets and theaters to cinemas for users in the UK. The advertising settings received a little bit of an update. More specifically, they enabled a feature that hadn't been enabled before. Previous builds have an advertising menu that allow you to do things like limit ad tracking. And on that same screen, there is a reset advertising identifier button. That feature was non-functional up until this build, which now has enabled it. In the new build, there is now a voice dial only setting. This is for customers who use the voice control option instead of Siri for doing things like placing phone calls. You can now set an option so that voice control only works for dialing. This would do things like prevent voice control from accidentally playing a track in the music app when you meant to call someone, specifically if you have someone in your contacts list who may have a similar name to an artist in your iTunes library. And then finally, cellular data control has been added for iTunes. You can now implicitly turn off cellular data just for the iTunes application, meaning that it will prevent downloading of tracks over 3G or 4G, eating up your data connection. I have to wonder if that feature being enabled and turned on, if Apple, along with that, when they release this update, will also remove the restriction on the size of a file that you can download over cellular. Currently, that limit is set, I think, at 50 gigabytes. I think if customers would have the ability to specifically say, don't download anything over 4G, or yes, I want you to be able to download files over 4G, that Apple could potentially remove that restriction. And then finally in the news for this week, let's talk about some Macs getting the Made in the USA label, or at least the Assembled in the USA label. This really had already been the case for a very small subset of Macs. Refurbished units for a while have been actually made in the USA or refurbished and reassembled in the USA, and they do get that labeling. If you've ever gotten a refurbished Mac from Apple, you may have noticed that. As a matter of fact, there have been images of certain iMacs and certain models having that moniker online. This week, though, or over the past couple of weeks, when the 21.5-inch iMacs started shipping, several places noticed that at least some of the units were arriving with an Assembled in the USA label. It's not clear exactly how many iMacs were being assembled in the US, nor exactly where or by whom they were being assembled. And it's also been noted that not every 21.5-inch model has the Assembled in the USA label. Some are still arriving carrying the Assembled in China label, and it's not been proven what percentage or how many. So there's a lot of questions still about the current units. 9to5 Mac did do some digging and working along with their readers to kind of track shipments of some of the new Macs going from origin to the destination, and found that at least two of their readers had Macs that were shipped from the San Jose area, and possibly more specifically from Fremont. Fremont is an interesting choice for Apple because that's actually where Apple's first Mac plant was before they moved it to Elk Grove, California. So the original Macs were originally produced out of Fremont, so there'd be a little history going along with that. What is clear now, though, is that even if there's just a few iMacs currently being assembled in the U.S., that number of Macs is set to grow. In that interview I talked about earlier that Tim Cook gave to Bloomberg, and also on the NBC piece, Tim Cook revealed that next year Apple would bring some production to the U.S. of the Mac. He didn't provide too many specifics, but did say that Apple planned to invest over $100 million in a new effort. He also said that Apple would not be doing it themselves and would be working with people to make it happen. Who will they be working with? Well, at this point, Foxconn seems like a very likely choice. Foxconn actually already has plants in California and Texas and has been reportedly looking into expanding their U.S. operations. It's currently not believed that either of those facilities, Texas or California, are doing any work for Apple. But in addition to them looking to expand their operations in California, the Foxconn chairman also recently said that they had plans to take U.S. engineers, bring them to China to train them on manufacturing, and send them back home, presumably to work at plants in the U.S. So which Mac model is going to be the one that's going to be made here in the United States? Well, Tim Cook said at least one Mac model would be exclusively made in the U.S. starting in 2013, and early bets are on the new Pro Mac model that he said was coming. I personally feel this would be a logical choice for Apple, and everything I've been reading about it seems to be pointing in that direction and make a lot of sense. My theory is that Apple is going to move slowly into U.S. production of Macs. They're going to want to ramp up. It's going to be a learning process for them on how to actually do it. And the Mac Pro ships in lower quantities than almost any other Mac that Apple makes, specifically if you compare it to things like the MacBook Pro. And so that's going to give them time to kind of figure processes out. Another advantage of the Mac Pro model is that it does carry a higher price point. So any higher labor costs or manufacturing costs that they might incur are going to be able to be absorbed, I think, a little bit more easily. It's going to be less of an issue for Apple. And then compared to other Mac models, I do think it's a little bit more easy to assemble. You have a large case, a standard motherboard design with slotted components that just plug in, processor slots and things like that. So you can really do a lot of the component assembly pretty easily. When you compare it again to things like the Mac Pro models or the iMacs, you don't have, you know, SSD or flash components that are soldered to the board. You don't have custom battery designs that need to be fitted in and soldered to the board. You don't have things like fused glass displays. That's a lot of advanced technology, and the plants and assembly facilities in China have a lot of experience in producing those sorts of components. Apple is going to have to be figuring out some new processes and things like that that work in the States, and it's definitely going to be a different operation. So they're going to want to start with a model that's maybe a little bit simpler to produce, and the Mac Pro seems like a likely choice for that. I think Apple is being very smart and realistic about this move, and I'm excited to see how well it works for them, and I know that they're going to be pretty cautious in sort of how they roll it out. There's also going to be a lot of scrutiny of Apple and what they're doing, and actually they're already getting hit by some of their detractors, unfortunately. I kind of figured this would happen, but it has been surprising how quickly some of the, I wouldn't call them negative because I think the reports are being pretty benign in terms of how they're presenting the information, but obviously they're showing that, you know, despite all the hype that sort of immediately generated after Apple made this announcement showing that Apple's going to bring manufacturing back to the U.S., they're going to bring jobs back to the U.S., we start getting reports like ones from Macworld who already speculate that the plant is going to be highly automated. And then Bloomberg comes along and says that economists and industry experts are projecting that Apple's new effort is only going to create 200 jobs. And so it's not going to be this huge job creating machine. But it does have to start somewhere. Another report that I read said the projected output is only set to be around 1 million units. And the reason for that, again, would be that Apple needs to do a lot of learning in this process and they need to ease into it. And doing that conservative sort of effort makes sense because as it rolls along, they're going to be able to learn things and apply those or apply that learning and continue to build this up. And, you know, this is something that not a lot of companies do. There are a few other technology companies, a few other consumer electronic companies who are doing stuff in manufacturing in the U.S., but it is all pretty small, but we have to build from somewhere. And I'm hoping that we're going to hear more positive reports and more people supporting Apple's efforts, and hopefully more and more companies are going to follow their lead. I think that's something that Apple is thinking is going to happen. And of course, there are already those who claim that Apple is, or their manufacturing partner really, will be getting a lot of tax breaks and sort of incentives from the government, and that's a big reason why they're doing this. But I don't really buy that as either. I think that this is something that Apple's been working on for a couple years. I think Tim Cook even alluded to that in the interviews. They've been wanting to bring some manufacturing back to the U.S. They already do a number of the component pieces in the U.S., and Tim Cook has been pointing that out for a while. You know, the processors, the A5 processors and A6 processors are manufactured and made in Texas. The glass for iOS devices is made by Corning in Kentucky. So this is just bringing another part of Apple's manufacturing over to the United States. And I think no matter what is said, this is a really great effort and could hopefully have long-term and meaningful effect in bringing at least some manufacturing back to the United States. And that overall is a really good thing. I think it's just sort of frustrating that you're never going to be able to satisfy all parties. You know, there's been people that have been screaming for the last couple years that Apple needs to get out of China and bring manufacturing back to the U.S. And now that it's happening, we're going to see the detractors from the other side saying that Apple isn't doing enough, that this isn't, you know, they've got billions of dollars in the bank and they're not spending enough money, that the investment isn't enough. And I feel like screaming sometimes. We've got to start somewhere. So let's give this a chance and see where it goes. And so I'm very excited and interested to see what happens. I know this isn't very likely, but I sometimes really feel like someone at Apple is listening to this podcast and using it to make some of the decisions that go on there. It's really crazy, and I don't think that's actually what's happening. But I find it interesting, timing-wise, that we had, on the last few episodes, talked about Office on tablets. Specifically, I think we were talking about the Surface tablet and the full version of Office being on the Surface tablet and not available on iOS. And I had often mentioned, well, you know, Pages on iOS is pretty darn good, but the problem that I hear from most Office workers and most people that use Word, they say that a big feature that is missing from Pages on iOS has been track changes. And that feature is available on Pages for the desktop, but has not been available for iOS. And now that has happened. Apple has updated iWork for iOS, and they added the track changes feature. So it's really just eerie how the timing works out. But Apple did this week update the iWork apps, and overall they say that what they added was major compatibility updates with desktop software like Office and iWork for the Mac. And the huge deal for our conversation is updates to track changes on Pages. So now in Pages documents, you can get track changes, you can enable it, and you can also import and export those track changes to Microsoft Word documents. And that's the key critical part. So I don't know how feature robust track changes is in iOS, in Pages on iOS. I don't know if it's going to work for those customers who need to be able to take their Word documents from their PC and exchange them with, say, their iPad and work on them and then exchange them back. I'm going to be very interested to find out if some of you live in that world. Maybe you can tell us how it works out for you. I'm definitely not a Word expert, so I don't know how compatible it actually is. But I did try it out really quickly. I updated my version of Pages, and I just went in and turned on the feature. What you can do is you can turn on track changes, and then once you do that, you kind of have three views. You can view the markup. You can view the markup without deletion, meaning the changes, or the changes without the deletions, and then you can view it in its final form. And as you're making changes, specifically deletions, what will happen is you'll get the little line through, and you'll see that within the Pages document itself. You can actually tap on a change, and that gives you the ability to accept or reject that change. So I assume as you're exchanging documents back and forth, you can see the different changes people are making on them and then either accept them or reject them. Now, one thing I didn't see was a way to view sort of the full change history. So once you've accepted a change, can I go back and see all the different changes that were applied to the document before I did that exception? I didn't see that there, but I don't even know if that's an option on the desktop versions of the apps, either Pages on the Mac desktop or Word for that matter. So you'll have to let me know if you're a track changes person, if this is something that is even viable or even matters or makes a difference to the conversation we've been having. And I look forward to getting some of your feedback. You can send that to maccast@gmail.com. As promised at the top of the show, I have a couple of iTunes 11 tips and tricks for you. We talked, I think, a little bit on the last episode about the release of iTunes 11. Big update for Apple. I'm really enjoying the new version. There were some things that have gone missing and some things that were added, but overall, I'm very happy with the update. This week, I wanted to cover a few little tips and tricks that I ran across as I was doing research for the show. One big new feature that's in iTunes 11 is the Up Next playlist. So you have the ability to add items to the Up Next list. You can also view what's coming up as you're listening to music, as you're listening to an album or a playlist, or even just doing a shuffle. You can click the little icon there that looks like a list view in the player, and it'll drop down and show you the upcoming tracks. And I think we talked about on the last episode that you can add items to that track by clicking on the little arrow icon that is next to a track name or an album or something like that. You'll see it throughout the interface. There's this little arrow icon, and then you get a pop-out menu that gives you options to add to Up Next or to Play Next. Now, one conversation we had on We Have Communicators is, what's the difference between those two things? It wasn't really immediately obvious, and I've been playing around with it a little bit, and as near as I can tell, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like that the Play Next option, what it'll do is it'll add the item to the top of the Up Next playlist, meaning that it's going to be immediately the next track that it plays. If you use the Add to Up Next option, it seems to place it at the bottom of the Up Next list. What's confusing, though, or at least was for me at first, was that if you're already playing music, so if you're already playing an album where you're in shuffle mode or you're playing through a playlist and you add something to the Up Next list, it becomes this sort of separate playlist that gets inserted in front of the music that you're currently playing. So when you drop down the list, you'll see your Up Next list, and then you'll see an option that says Back to Music. And so what'll happen is it'll start playing through things in your Up Next list, anything that you add to it, either to the top or the bottom. And then once it's scrolled through and played through all those tracks, it'll jump back to the original music that you're playing. So kind of an interesting feature, but Up Next really is this sort of wholly separate playlist that you jump into and then jump back out of. And so once you understand that, the options for Play Next and Add to Up Next make a little bit more sense, at least I think. But there are some other ways to add stuff to your Up Next playlist that weren't immediately obvious. One cool way is you can actually drag an item, a song, an album, or an entire playlist up into the iTunes LCD window, and when you drop it, a little animation will flash sort of over the album art area and or over the Up Next list area, excuse me, and it will throw that into your Up Next list, whatever you drug up there. Another quick way that you can do it is if you hold down the Option key while hovering over an item, you will see a little plus icon appear next to the item or somewhere near the item. It depends on what kind of item you're hovering over. For songs, it appears to be sort of to the left of the track and replaces the track number. If you're holding down the Option key and you hover over an album or a playlist, you'll notice the little plus icon appear over the play button, and then clicking on that little plus icon will immediately add whatever you're hovering over or whatever you clicked on to the Up Next playlist. So two different ways to add items to that Up Next playlist that you may have not caught on to before. Another thing that you can do is in the search box, you can limit your searches to specific media types. By default now, when you're doing a search, it searches your whole entire library, regardless of what kind of media type it is. It then organizes the results in the little dropdown into different types of media. So you'll see your music separated from your movies, but it's all sort of a universal search. If you click on the little magnifying glass icon, though, in the search box, what you'll see is there's a search entire library item. If you select that, it'll actually uncheck that item, and then you can search whatever current playlist or current library you're in. So if you're in your music library, what you'll notice is the search box, the text in the search box will change from search library to search music. If you're in the movies section of your library, it'll say search movies. So you can switch between the different media libraries and then specifically search within that. And once you're searching inside specific media libraries, if you click on that magnifying glass, you may notice also that there's some filter options to let you further refine your search results. So you can search specific criteria like artist, song, title, etc. So that can make finding things a little bit more specific. One of the really cool new features of iTunes 11 is the totally redesigned mini player. And I was at my user group meeting this week presenting things, and we were showing off the mini player. And a friend of mine in the audience immediately noticed that my mini player would have the controls fade away when I hovered off of it. And then the mini player would show the title and artist information next to the currently playing track's album art. And he said his wasn't doing that, and we couldn't figure out why for the life of us. And so then I was doing the We Have Communicators podcast. We started talking about it there, and Michael Johnston actually figured out what was going on. What we discovered was that the mini player now offers full keyboard control if you've enabled it in the system preferences keyboard preferences. You can tell if you have a keyboard control enabled because the controls in the mini player will have a blue glow around them to indicate which control is currently selected for keyboard control or has keyboard focus. And if any of the play controls, either the play button, the fast forward, rewind, or AirPlay icons have focus currently, then the artist and track information isn't displayed because it's just like as if you had hovered over it with your mouse. So if you press the tab key until the focus is on the Up Next playlist icon, what you'll notice is then the track and artist information for the currently playing track will fade into view. If you want to disable full keyboard control access for iTunes, or actually more specifically the entire operating system, what you can do is you can go into System Preferences, go to the Keyboard Preferences, and then click on the Keyboard Shortcuts tab. There you'll notice there's a setting called Full Keyboard Access, and if you change it from All Controls to just Text Boxes and Lists Only, and then close the Mini Player and reopen it, what you'll notice is you'll no longer have those sort of keyboard-focused icons with the blue glow around them. You'll actually just be able to hover over the controls. They'll appear, and when you hover off of them, they'll disappear regardless of where you've clicked or what you have selected. The one thing to know about disabling the full keyboard access control for all controls in the System Preferences is if you do that, it may potentially impact other applications. So it's not just for iTunes. That setting goes across the entire operating system. But I found that very interesting that I hadn't noticed there was sort of this different view for the Mini Player, but I hadn't noticed because I had my keyboard access set to just text boxes and lists only. And that's not too surprising for me because I am a total mouse person. I know that keyboard control is a much quicker way of getting to things. I'm trying to get better at this stuff. So the last tip I wanted to give you is some keyboard shortcuts that you can use inside iTunes, specifically iTunes 11. But I think a lot of these actually go back for other versions of iTunes. One very common one, and I actually do use this one, is to use the space bar to play or pause. Now, if you have full keyboard control on the Mini Player, I did notice that tapping the space bar acts as a mouse click and will not actually play pause your music. So that was a little bit confusing. But normally, if you just hit the space bar, you can start the music playing. Another keyboard shortcut that's kind of cool is if you press the command left or command right keys, it skips forward or backward a track. Now, one change that I noticed in iTunes 11 is that if I just tap the left arrow or the right arrow without even using the command modifier, it does seem to do the same thing as well. So it'll skip forward a track or back a track. Command up or command down will allow you to raise or lower the volume within iTunes. And now that iTunes 11 sort of has the one window interface and you no longer have that sidebar unless you enable it for accessing the different media libraries, there are some cool keyboard shortcuts for jumping between libraries. If you hold down the command key and then press any number key, 1 through 7, it'll jump between the different media libraries. So command 1 is your music library, command 2 is movies, command 3 TV shows, command 4 podcasts, command 5 is iTunes U, command 6 is books, and command 7 will jump to the app library. So you can quickly switch between the different libraries without even having to touch your mouse, and I thought that was pretty cool. Another cool one is for the new Up Next playlist. You can actually access that directly from the keyboard. If you hit command option plus U, it'll bring up the Next Up playlist. You can hit the escape key and that will close the Up Next list. Another handy one is switching between the main library and the Mini Player. Command option M will allow you to jump back and forth between those two different views. And then finally, if you want to use a keyboard shortcut to add items to the Up Next playlist, you can select a track in your library and then press the option plus return key, and it will add it as a play next item. Now, one thing I noticed in my case is that if you're already playing something or you already have something currently added to your Up Next playlist, it'll pop up a dialogue and it will ask you or tell you that you're about to start playback and you want to clear the X number of songs that are currently in the Up Next playlist. You have a couple different options for doing that. You can go ahead and clear the list and add the track that you just tried to add. If you want to keep the items in your Up Next playlist and just add the one item as the next item, you can simply tap the P key to accept the dialogue that does not clear the list. If you just hit return, it will actually clear the list because that's actually the default option. So just be aware of that. It's a bummer that there's that sort of extra dialogue that pops up. It kind of defeats the purpose of the shortcut, but it's still good to know about anyway. And then for all of those of us who are missing the Find Duplicates feature, probably, in my opinion, the most disappointing omission from the iTunes 11 update was the loss of the Find Duplicates feature, which I know a lot of us use to kind of clean up our iTunes library. Well, this week, Walt Mossberg did say in his iTunes 11 review that Apple told him they would be bringing that feature back in a future minor update. No word on when that'll happen. Hopefully it'll be in the very next update because I know I want that feature back. But there's some good news and some hints and tricks for iTunes 11. If you've discovered some of your own that you particularly like, please share those with us. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Daniel sent me an email this week, and he was having a little issue with Dropbox, and specifically using Dropbox inside Safari. But what was interesting about Daniel's email was that it reminded me that, you know, sometimes when something goes wrong with a bit of technology or a piece of software or a Mac specifically, we think we know where the problem is. We think what the issue is the application that we're working with. But very often that might end up being wrong, and that's not actually where the issue lies. In his specific case, Daniel was using the web interface for Dropbox inside Safari and suddenly noticed that he was unable to access the share folder options, specifically when he would click on what would be the menu dropdown for accessing those options. It wouldn't work inside Safari, and he was able to get it to work inside another browser, and it definitely at that point then felt or seemed like some sort of bug between Dropbox and Safari. But after troubleshooting with the Dropbox support, they recommended that he look into his Safari extensions. And sure enough, it was an extension that he had installed that ended up being the culprit. So the thing is that many web-based services like Dropbox rely on technologies like JavaScript to do their magic. And also, many extensions that we use in our browsers also leverage JavaScript. So it's very possible that something like an extension or a plugin or an add-on could cause some sort of conflict that would be outside of the control of the host application. So in this case, Safari had no idea of knowing, or Dropbox, their web application, had no idea of knowing that it was this extension that was sort of causing the problem. It makes troubleshooting this stuff particularly difficult, not only for web developers, but also for just us as end users. And this kind of thing can happen with Safari, Firefox, Chrome. It doesn't really matter because all of those browsers offer extensions. And it goes even further than that because it's not just browsers and web services that have these kinds of issues. It's also our entire operating system and different applications. There's many applications that have plugin architectures. So very often you maybe have installed a plugin into an application and that's the source of your problem rather than the core application itself. With Mac OS X, you can have things like menu bar items and background processes and even things like preference panes that might be running stuff in the background that can sometimes cause conflicts. And you may or may not realize it. You might think that, hey, I recently ran that application update, or I recently ran that software update, and you think, oh, there's something wrong with that update, and it turns out to be a conflict that was introduced with another application that's outside the control of the core application. So I thought it was good to just remind ourselves that sometimes when things go wrong, there's some other areas outside applications or core applications that we may want to check. And specifically, those things would be things like menu bar items. Have you recently added something to your menu bar? And could that potentially be the culprit? Another one you very often want to check, because sometimes you'll install an application and not even realize that it's installed a login item, something that's actually running in the background to help support that application, but isn't readily apparent. There's no user interface for it. And the place you want to go to look for those is go into System Preferences, go into the User and Group Preference pane, and check the Login Items tab and see what's in there. See if there's something in there that maybe you didn't know was in there before, and potentially you know, disable that temporarily and see if that problem goes away. Another place to check would be just in the Activity Monitor. So go into Applications Utilities, launch Activity Monitor, and look at the different processes that are running and see if there isn't some maybe background process that might be causing an issue. A helpful thing to do is to filter that view or that list down just to the My Processes, which are just the processes started by your user account or the account that you're logged into. And it may show a background process or an application that you have installed that could be causing an issue. If you see something in that list, a good tip is if you don't know what it is or if it's not readily apparent maybe what application it's tied to, just Google for whatever the process is called, and you'll be able to get a wealth of information on sort of what's going on your operating system. There's a lot of background processes that are running, and a lot of them need to be there. But if you see one that maybe looks out of the ordinary or maybe is using a lot of resources or something like that, you might want to just check into it a little bit further. And, you know, if you do find a specific problem with a particular piece of software or an add-on or some sort of background process, you might just want to contact the developer, especially if it's something that was triggered by a recent update maybe to the operating system or to a core application. You may want to contact the developer and just make sure that they don't already have an update, something that'll patch and potentially fix the issue. And so in Daniel's case, it was simply, you know, emailing the support team at Dropbox, and they said, hey, you know, you might want to look at your Safari extensions. And then just simply disabling that extension resolved Daniel's issue. Now, Daniel, I don't know if you went back to the developer of that add-on or extension to see if they had an update, but you potentially might want to contact them and let them know about the problem, because maybe they don't even realize it's going on yet, and they can work on a patch and issue an update to get it resolved for other users. But thanks for your email, because that is a good reminder that, you know, we need to look at all areas of the operating system and all things that we've done recently to sort of update it when we're troubleshooting these kinds of issues. Danny sent me an email this week to let me know about a particularly frustrating problem he is having with the App Store, and specifically with an update to iPhoto 11. The App Store keeps telling him that he has an update available, but when he goes to check iPhoto, he is completely up to date in terms of his version number, yet every time the App Store says he needs to update, and when he tries to update, it then errors, letting him know that he can't update the software because it's already installed, and then immediately asks them if he would like to try and update again, even though it can't complete the update. So it's a sort of vicious circle where it won't let him upgrade. And Danny, I looked into this a little bit. I have two recommendations. I'm not sure which one is going to work. The first one I would try is to actually just go to Apple's support website. So go outside of the App Store update. Just go to support.apple.com/downloads and search for the latest iPhoto 11 update. Download that and try running the updater manually and see if that doesn't sort of reset things and sort of let the App Store app know that, hey, I've updated iTunes 11. It's fully up to date. I'm not sure if that'll work. A couple people had recommended on the discussion forums over at Apple's support website that that does fix and resolve that issue. The other fix, I think, is a little bit more extreme, at least in terms of the time it's going to take to kind of resolve the issue, but does seem to be the one that most people are recommending when you run into this situation where the App Store isn't sort of updating or isn't recognizing that an app is up to date. And that resolution is to rebuild the Spotlight Index. And the reason for this is that apparently the App Store uses the Spotlight Index to get some of the information about the apps that you have installed and information related to those applications. And specifically, I would imagine in this case, what the current build number is that you have installed. And so to rebuild the Spotlight Index, the easiest way to go about it is to go into the System Preferences, go into the Spotlight Preference pane, and then click on the Privacy tab. From there, you click the little plus button, and what you're going to want to do is add your main boot volume, your hard drive, to the privacy list. And what that's going to do is going to wipe out and clear out the current Spotlight index, basically telling Spotlight, don't index my boot drive. And so once you've added that, quit and then relaunch the system preferences. Go back into the Spotlight preferences. Again, click on the Privacy tab. Select the hard drive icon that you just added. And then click the minus button to remove it from the list and quit system preferences. So what this is going to do is then immediately start Spotlight re-indexing and rebuilding the database, the Spotlight database for your hard drive. And this can take some time, so be prepared for that. As a matter of fact, I usually recommend people perform the rebuild Spotlight database procedure right before they go to bed. Just leave your machine on overnight, let it run, let it, you know, do it at a point when you're not going to be using your Mac so that it can just run as a background process, because it can take several hours to rebuild that database. But once it's rebuilt, supposedly you should get past this issue of being in this infinite update loop with the App Store app. Again, I haven't tried this or run into this situation personally myself, but I found several discussion threads on Apple's support website that allude to this being the fix for your issue. I will tell you also, if you don't want to go through the whole system preference, add and remove from the privacy list your hard drive thing, you can actually use a tool like Onyx or Cocktail to go in and tell it, force it to rebuild the Spotlight database. I think there's also a command line, a terminal command that you can run to sort of wipe out and get Spotlight to rebuild its database. But really the easiest is to just go through the system preferences procedure. So I hope one of these things helps resolve your issue. If anybody else has run into this and has a different fix for this issue, let us know and I can pass that along to Danny. And then finally, today I have a tip from Ty that I thought was pretty cool. It's actually something I've known about and I've actually taken advantage of myself in the past. But, you know, if you have a coin jar, many of us do, you know, you get home at the end of the day, you take your change out of your pocket and you throw it into that jar over in the corner or on your dresser, wherever it might be, and it just piles up for years and years, and then you've got this giant jar of coins. Well, many of us know about Coinstar. That's something that's here in the States. I don't know if you have it all over the world. I would imagine there's similar services. If it's not Coinstar, it's some other service. But here in the States, what we can do is we can take that coin jar, we can take it to the grocery store, and there's a machine, and you dump the change in the machine. It counts it all up, and it allows you to convert your coins into a voucher. You take that to the register, and they give you cash in the value of your coins, less a service fee normally. Coinstar takes, I think, about a 10% service fee for the feature of, you know, using the machine to count your coins, and that's how they make their money. But there is an option at these machines where you can get that service fee waived if you convert your change into a gift card from a number of different companies that partner with Coinstar. So companies like Amazon, Starbucks, and The Gap, as well as Apple and iTunes, they will waive that fee. They'll absorb that 10% fee if you get a gift card. And the, you know, thing here is you're going to spend the money over on Amazon or Apple. So Apple's going to make up the difference. So they're willing to pay the 10% fee. You can also, interestingly, have the money donated to charity, the Red Cross, the Humane Society, UNICEF, World Wildlife Fund, etc. So it's a good way to take that change jar and convert it into something a little more useful and not just have it wasted away sitting on your bureau or whatever there. And you can get that cash back into the economy, and that's a good thing, especially in these times when, you know, the economy's down a little bit. So let's get that money flowing again. I thought this was a great tip for doing that. And currently, here's a bonus, they are running a promotion that if you opt for an iTunes gift card, they're going to give you $10 more than the actual value of the funds, assuming you put in $40 or more worth of change. So you put in $40, they're going to give you a $50 gift card. You put in $60, they're going to give you a $70 gift card. And unfortunately, when I went to check on this, there's a page on the Coinstar website that has the special offers. It actually ends today, but I'm hoping that maybe it got extended. So just head to coinstar.com/special/special offers, and you can check and see if they've extended this one. But they seem to have the offer for a number of the different gift cards that they have up there. And thanks, Ty, for sending that tip in. It's a great way to turn that extra change into something a little more useful. And with that, that'll do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, Disc Label, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can get more information on all their software and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle's the fast, simple way to sell your used iPhones, iPads, and other smartphones. Find out what your gadget is worth today at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails and your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. If you have a question, you have a comment, you can send that to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and leave a voicemail there. You could also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. And be sure to check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And I probably should also mention that this week, Google Plus launched new Google Plus communities. There is now a MacCast community. I don't have the short URL for that, but if you just search on Google Plus for MacCast, I'm sure it will pop up. And I'll try and throw a link in the show notes, or at least in the post over at maccast.com. But I'd love to have you join me on the new Google Plus community. So check all of that out. And that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.